The old adage, don't sit too close to the TV, might also need a revision. Try don't sit in front of the TV at all. A new study links time in front of the tube with increased risk of death. And we're not talking about, you know, radiation that might be coming out of the front of your TV like in the old days. The study published in the American Heart Association journal Circulation, listen to this, it found that for every hour of daily TV time, that correlated with an 18% increased risk of death from cardiovascular disease. But it isn't just heart disease. Each hour of couch potatoing was linked with an 11% risk from death from all causes. Here to tell us what makes TV time bad for your health is the study author, David Dunstan. He is the head of physical activity at the Baker IDI Heart and Diabetes Institute in Melbourne, Australia. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good evening.
G'day.
Good day. Good day. Say good day to you. Is that true? It doesn't matter. Is it just sitting down and not doing something that the problem is here?
Well, I guess that's a very important point, that it's not television itself per se that is the problem. What we believe is that it's what people do whilst they're watching television, because we know that the default position for many of us when we're watching television is sitting. And this new evidence adds to the evidence that too much sitting is potentially bad for our health.
And how much sitting do you have to do to start noticing there's a problem?
Well, I guess within this study, you've already mentioned some of the findings, but another key finding was that when we compared people who watched less than 2 hours of television per day, people who watched more than 4 hours a day had a 46% higher risk of death from all causes and an 80% increased risk of death from cardiovascular disease. So it appeared that the higher amounts of TV significantly increased the risk.
46%, 4 hours a day? That, you know, the statistics in the United States were showing that the average person watches about 5 hours of TV a day here.
Yeah, and within Australia, our average is around about the 3 hours per day. So it does have serious implications, particularly for the U.S. Sort of population where you know, TV viewing is substantially higher than what exists here in Australia.
So if you're not sitting on the couch, if you just stand up and walk around, or that would be okay while you're watching television?
Well, I guess the key point here is that what it's providing evidence about is that too much sitting is bad for health. And, you know, we simply, from our lifestyle changes that have been induced by our modern society, many of us simply move from chair to chair throughout the day, from the seat in the car to the chair in the office to the couch at home. So what we've tended to underestimate is the true benefit that can be derived from these incidental or these non-sweaty type movements. Because what we've seen is that the more you move, the greater the likely benefits for your health.
What goes on in your body to make just these simple movements? You don't have to be aerobic, as you're saying. You just have to move around a bit. What's going on in your body to help you?
Well, the possible explanations for this really come down to the muscles moving. And when we're sitting for prolonged periods, we're not burning up much energy. And it appears that television contributes to an overall reduction in the amount of calories that we burn throughout the day. In fact, there are studies that have actually shown that when we're sitting watching television, we burn as much energy as what we do when we're sleeping or at rest. So it's very low energy expenditure. And over a period of, you know, 4 or 5 hours, that's quite low energy expenditure. The other consequence that we're starting to understand now is that when we're sitting for prolonged times, such as, you know, in front of the television or long hours in front of the computer screen at the desk, there's an absence of muscle contractions. And there's extensive evidence that indicates that muscle contractions are so essential for many of the body's regulatory processes. For example, the breaking down and using of glucose. So when we're remaining idle for prolonged periods, we're disrupting those body's typical regulatory processes.
So get off your chair and get up and move, is what you're saying. Get out of the car, take a walk, just something a little bit, doesn't it? You don't have to, you know, do a lot of sweaty exercise, is what you're saying.
Well, I think the important point here that this does not negate the important benefits of undertaking regular exercise. There's mm-hmm. substantial evidence that exercise is important. But what we now have to take stock at is looking at what are we doing when we're not exercising or we're not sleeping, which for many of us, even if we exercise for 30 minutes to 60 minutes of the day, that still leaves 15 hours of the day, if we sleep 8 hours, that is, for these non-exercise time, non-sleeping time. So what we're trying to encourage people is to think about avoiding prolonged periods of sitting, move more often.
So you're saying that even people who you studied who were really good exercisers, who were very active and they exercised, you know, like we see most people telling us that we should be doing and they're on the treadmill and whatever, even those people, when they sat down for a while, they fell right into that category.
And this is a really interesting finding, and that is the case. And what we did, we factored in people's exercise levels into our analyses. And even when we factored that in, the relationship between TV remained robust. That is, it persisted even when we accounted for people's exercise levels, which I think this indicates that you can still exercise, but spend high amounts of the remainder of the day sedentary, or you can still watch significantly higher amounts of television. It was more the higher amounts of television that led to the increased risk.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatto talking with David Dunstan. Let's go to the phones to Brandon in Bellingham, Washington. Hi, Brandon. Brandon, are you there? Hello, Brandon. No. 3, 2, 1. Strike three. Well, yeah, he wanted to ask a question, and I think you might have answered it already. Does it make a difference if you're just sitting and reading a book? You know, television was used as the model in the study, but I guess just sitting and reading a book would have the same effect.
No, that's a good point. And as you indicated, within this study, we specifically focused on television because we had previously seen that to be a good indicator of a person's overall sedentary behavior pattern. I guess the message that I come back to again here
right.
is that it's the sitting time that appears to be detrimental to health. And, of course, prolonged sitting while I'm reading, great for the mind.
Right.
But I think the important point here, don't stop your reading. Get up and move frequently throughout the movement, through the reading is probably the important message.
Well, this is great. This is great for people who are throwing Super Bowl parties, you know, because instead of just sitting on the couch, they're up yelling, screaming, going around and, you know, carrying on.
Yeah, we often get asked, so what can we do if we want to watch our favorite TV show? Well, one strategy would be to utilize the commercial breaks or the breaks in the TV show to get up and move about and get those muscles moving. Again, move more often. If you're standing up and moving about, you're not sedentary.
Mm-hmm. And did you look at diet at all? Did that make any difference?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And we did account for people's diet overall in terms of their diet quality. And even when we accounted for that, the relationship still persisted. But what there has been evidence earlier from other studies is that increased poor snacking may take place with television viewing due to the cues that people have through commercial breaks and the television shows. But we didn't address that, or we haven't addressed that just yet. We are now moving towards starting to understand that a little bit more.
Is there any minimum? Were you able to find out what minimum amount of movement we would need to offset that clock that's ticking?
That is the question that we need to explore further within our research, and we're actually moving a little bit more towards looking at this in an experimental level by having people come into our laboratory and we ask them to sit for the 7 hours, but on another day we ask them to sit, but we get them up every 20 minutes for 2 minutes to see whether that interruption can lead to more favorable blood glucose levels, blood fat levels. So I think it's stay tuned for that one because that's where we're currently working on.
I see you did bring people and have them get up every 20 minutes, and you're still working on that data. is what you're saying.
Yeah, we're still working on that data. We're halfway through the collection of that data, but that will give us some important insights to the question that you just asked there in terms of how often should we get people up and how long for.
All right, so if you're going to be watching TV, walk around a bit, you know, or get on the treadmill when you're watching, even if you're just walking slowly, just to do some sort of movement.
Also complete some of our household chores if that's feasible. The folding of the washing of the dishes while we're watching our favorite TV show. The important point here is not to, miss your favorite TV show, but keep moving while you're watching that favorite TV show.
Back to Ozzie and Harriet, which was a big show in the old days, but I don't think she ever folded anything. All right. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And thanks for staying out late for us. David Dunston is head of physical activity at the Baker IDI Heart and Diabetes Institute in Melbourne, Australia, which is probably about 17 hours ahead. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Shelley Du Bois is our site arts producer. Neil Rausch is our technical director. And sliding those faders here in New York. We also had help in Second Life from Lynn Collins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and University of Denver. And if you'd like to write us, please surf over to our website and you can leave us email there, or you could do it the classic way. You can send us a letter, postcard, or whatever. Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Also, we're tweeting at SciFry and all week, and podcasting and blogging, and surf over to sciencefriday.com, and you can help participate in our Science Friday community. I'm Ira Flatto in New York.
Andrea Arnold's second feature, Fish Tank, won the jury prize at the 2009 Cannes Film Festival. It's a coming-of-age story of a complicated teenage girl from a high-rise London housing project. It opens today in New York and is available on demand from IFC Films. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
From the start, I knew the British director Andrea Arnold had captured something volatile and splendid in her second feature, Fish Tank. A girl named Katie Jarvis plays London East End 15-year-old Mia, who in the first shots stares out the window of a high-rise working-class project from a vacant flat where she practices hip-hop with tiny speakers. Mia has been phoning her best friend after a bad fight, and she heads out angrily and finds and confronts the girl in a yard practicing hip-hop with other girls. And one calls her skanky, and Mia instantly, like lightning, headbutts her and breaks her nose. As she stomps away, you can feel her insides churn, and Arnold's handheld camera is both on her and with her. Rage, shame, defiance, longing. There's emotion in the camera's every jitter and swerve. Jarvis is in nearly every shot of Fish Tank. She has soft eyes, but her Mia is angry and defensive and has a dirty mouth. She has a feral quality that keeps you watching her closely for fear of missing something. Mia's dancing helps to channel her feelings, but despite big dreams, she's no Billy Elliot, and her accent and snaggly English teeth remind you where she comes from. It's her energy, her attack, that convinces you she won't go down without a fight. In interviews, Arnold said she wanted to cast a non-actress, and Jarvis was discovered on a train platform having a fight with her boyfriend and didn't believe the casting agent who approached her was for real. Arnold's acclaimed first feature, Red Road, centered on another outsider, a woman who monitored security cameras and spied and then spied on a man from her past. The film was formally brilliant, nearly wordless in its first half, but it didn't have the abrasive power of Fish Tank. Mia is constantly under siege by her mean and narcissistic mother, played by Kirsten Waring, and even by her nasty kid sister. So when she meets her mom's very handsome new boyfriend, Connor, his attentiveness throws her. Connor is played by the terrific chameleon Irish actor Michael Fassbender, who shows up at breakfast without his shirt while Mia is watching and imitating a hip-hop video.
Don't mind me, girl. Carry on. I was enjoying it.
As if.
You making eggs?
No.
It's the water for this.
I'm making tea.
Okay. I'm a friend of your mother's. You dance like a black. It's a compliment.
And what would you know?
I watch videos, like everyone else.
And that makes you some kind of expert, does it?
You've got a mouth, haven't you?
That scene and others between Mia and Connor will conjure up so many different emotions in different viewers that a chart of one's responses would zigzag more than an electrocardiogram. The erotic charge is strong, and so is our sense that Connor has more in common with Mia than he does with her mother, who's older than he is and often drunk. So too is the sense that a relationship between Mia and Connor would be wrong and perilous. In its outline, if not its milieu, Fishtank bears a resemblance to the English art house hit In Education, but it has what that overrated film doesn't, something fevered and amorphous that suggests its characters are unsure of their own motives and that they're swimming, as the title implies, in a world with few options. Near the end, Mia's overcome with rage and on impulse does something shocking, nearly unforgivable. The sequence goes right to the verge of tragedy, but the final scenes have a transcendent mixture of hope and sadness that lifts kitchen sink realism to the realm of dramatic poetry. In Fishtank, nothing for Mia goes right, yet her fate never seems preordained. Her constant motion, whether dancing, hurling obscenities, or recklessly charging ahead, might be her salvation or her doom, but you don't know, even in the last frame. That's a sign of this movie's open and deeply humanist vision.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. I'm a TV critic, and I've been astounded by the latest round of the late-night TV talk show wars. And no matter what happens today, tonight, or next week, there's no question that already the gloves are off in a way they've never been before, at least not in public. Tuesday on ABC's Jimmy Kimmel Live, that show's host sided with Conan O'Brien by doing his entire show impersonating Jay Leno. And last night on NBC's Jay Leno show, Leno had Kimmel on during his 10 at 10 segment, throwing 10 questions at Kimmel, who was seen on a giant TV screen in a satellite interview connecting Burbank with Hollywood. Leno's second question threw down the gauntlet.
All right, question two. Besides doing a cruel impression of me, what is the worst idea your writers have ever pitched you?
Well, that was my idea, to be honest, but pitch a lot of bad ideas.
That set the tone, and the tone was vicious in both directions. When Leno asked Kimmel who in the world he would most like to interview, this was Kimmel's response.
You and Conan together.
Oh, okay.
I would like to have the two of you. I'd like just you. In fact, I'd like to do 12 at 12 with you tomorrow night,
really?
If you would be willing to do that, because I have a lot of questions to ask you about this whole thing. I don't think people care about what I have to say.
Yeah. I agree with that.
What's going on in your life.
Tomorrow night, tomorrow night's bad for me. All right, let's move on.
From that point on, both Leno and Kimmel knew that Leno was boxed in, forced to ask the rest of his prepared questions. And Kimmel just swung at them like softballs and swung for the fences. Best prank Kimmel ever pulled?
Number five, you're known for pranks. What's the best prank you ever pulled?
Well, when my Aunt Chippy was at work, I painted her house orange and green once, and she was not happy.
Really?
The whole outside of the house was orange. Yeah. But I think the best prank I ever pulled was I told a guy that 5 years from now, I'm going to give you my show. And then when the 5 years came, I gave it to him, and then I took it back almost instantly.
Wow.
It was hilarious.
Wow, that's fine.
He still has the
good prank. Very good prank.
I think he works at Fox or something
now. Yeah, I got you. All right, number six. Ever order anything off the TV?
Like NBC ordered your show off the TV?
No. Actually, something like that, yeah.
Leno took a real risk, though, when asking question number nine.
Number nine, is there anything you haven't hosted that you want to host?
Oh, this is a trick, right?
Where no.
You get me to host The Tonight Show and then take it back from
me? No.
I'm not going to. Listen.
No.
Listen, Lucy, I'm not Charlie Brown. I don't fall for that trick.
And even when the 10 questions were up, Kimmel squeezed off one final shot. And it was a bullseye. Oh,
really? Listen, Jay, Conan and I have children.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All you have to take care of is cars.
That's right.
I mean, we have lives to lead here. You've got $800 million. For God's sakes, leave our shows alone.
A plea from Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy, thank you very much, my friend. See you tonight. Jimmy Kimmel Live.
Yikes. No wonder the country is fascinated by this very public battle. It's got everybody talking. It's got the participants rolling out their A material. And it's even got me watching The Jay Leno Show and laughing.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. With a great deal of fanfare, the Bulletin of the Atomic Sciences has reset the doomsday clock. That's that symbolic measure of how close we are to annihilating ourselves. It has reset it back 1 minute. Humanity is now 60 seconds further away from destroying itself, according to the group who has been maintaining the clock since 1947. And back then, the clock stood at 7 minutes to midnight. Including this latest resetting, the clock has been moved 19 times. 19. It now stands at 6 minutes to midnight. And joining me now to talk more about the clock, why it was moved, and what that represents is my guest, Lawrence Krauss, co-chair of the board of sponsors for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and he is also director of the Origins Initiative, co-director of the Cosmology Initiative, and a foundation professor at Arizona State University in Tempe. Welcome back.
It's always nice to be here. It's always nice to be here, Ira.
So why did you decide on what you were going to do with the clock?
Well, as always, it's a difficult decision. There's many factors. There's a lot of rising tensions in the world in certain places, in Iran, etc. But I think that the main factor was that there's been a sense that there's been a sea change in the possibility for international cooperation regarding both nuclear weapons and climate change. There are now largely, one would have to say, as a result of the election of Barack Obama, new international talks and agreements to reduce arms. And so because of that, we felt that there was a net plus, but in fact, it's the first time in its history that we've just moved it by 1 minute.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's always moved by larger segments than that. And the message we want to send by that is that small movement presages a potentially much larger movement, which could go in one direction or other. If we don't follow up on all the talk that's been happening with action, it could go much closer to midnight. On the other hand, if all of these things that we hope are going to happen, it could move much further away.
Well, these things that you're talking about, it used to be just about nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
Now you've substituted global warming, or rather you've added that.
We've tried to look at what all the global threats are to humanity. The idea behind the clock is to reflect the global threats to humanity. And we've looked at three different areas primarily. Well, obviously, nuclear weapons and nuclear war. And now global climate change, which is clearly a global threat. And also we've looked at biotechnology and bioterrorism and decided, while we've been following that it doesn't yet reflect a potentially global threat. So it's an important thing to look at, but not yet.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned President Obama as being instrumental in your decision. Are you saying that if it had been a different president,
No.
might have gone a different way?
No, it's not. It doesn't reflect that in any way. What it reflects is the actions that have taken place since Obama has become president. Mm-hmm. Had a different president taken those actions, then the conclusion would have been the same. The idea that we are actually beginning to engage other nations in negotiations, and in fact, there's a few things that Obama's the first president to openly state that we should live in a world free of nuclear weapons, which is no longer such a radical proposal after George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn and others have proposed that. Mm-hmm. And so really it's because of what he's done initially as president that really has produced a change in perspective. And even Copenhagen, which has had its own problems, at least present for the first time nations came together and at least agreed to try and reduce greenhouse gases. And, of course, it was disappointing. But I think that the net feeling was that we're at a time where there's really perhaps for the first time in history the hope of beginning to move forward in that direction. And that hope alone was perhaps enough to move it back 1 minute. But we're sending a message that the 1 minute really means the clock's ticking. And if we don't act on this at this really almost unique time, this unique opportunity to do something, then it's quite likely we're going to move much closer to midnight.
If countries adopt more nuclear power plants, as they say they're going to be building, doesn't that put more potential nuclear materials at risk for terrorism or something like that?
Absolutely, and that's an issue that we've had to think about. In fact, we recommend that we do not do a wholesale growth in nuclear power as a way to purely combat climate change. But at the same time, we need to, if we're going to recognize that nuclear power is going to be a part of the package, we have to control fissile material. We have to have international agreements to control fissile material. And in fact, President Obama supported a treaty to do just that. So you're right that as we try and combat climate change, it's going to introduce other potential threats, and we have to balance those.
Who decides when to make a move or how to make a move? It's not done on a regular basis.
It hasn't been done on a regular basis at all. It's been done when there was a sense that there's important developments in the world that should cause that to change. It's not done. I should say it's not done in response to immediate crises either.
Right.
In fact, the bulletin has now evolved to become a much more to try and reach out to the public, because one of the things we say, and I tried to say it yesterday when we moved the clock back, is that scientists have a responsibility to speak out to the public to try and help them understand what the issues are. Government officials have a responsibility to act against these global threats. But really, this is only going to happen if there's strong public support. And so the bulletin has moved and become, in fact, as an organization, take back the clock,
yeah.
and is now an organization online, and has moved to try and affect public opinion, because ultimately that is going to be the driver of if we're really, you know, Einstein 65 years ago said after the first atomic bomb, he said, everything has changed, save the way we think, and that's the point. We really have to get people to think globally about these issues and realize that there is no such thing as a sane use of nuclear weapons in any way, and that we are far safer with far fewer, and that we have to combat as a world issues of global climate change, which is not just being modeled but is actually happening and can be measured.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that scientists themselves need to speak out, and if they were listened to, they would say that we would be safer without the nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. I think that scientists have spoken out many times and in a useful way to try and influence this. The most effective time I can think of is the 1972 ABM treaty, Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, where scientists played a role in basically convincing the government that we couldn't have a viable anti-ballistic missile system. And we're trying to again, in fact. And I think the point is that scientists shouldn't be lobbying, but we need to provide the information that's necessary for the public and government officials to act. And we also are quite aware of the devastating effects of nuclear weapons. Here's a recent result, for example. People have often thought, well, limited nuclear war is terrible, but it's limited. Well, a recent study by a group of physicists has pointed out that even a limited nuclear war between Pakistan and India, one with, say, 100 nuclear weapons, would be devastating enough to globally affect the climate around the world for at least a decade. And so
From the fallout.
Not just from the fallout, from the dust, the 5 million tons of smoke that will be dumped in the stratosphere. And they've done serious studies that now suggest that even a limited nuclear war could, and of course a much larger one, would indeed affect the global climate for a much longer period. And so people have to realize that we're not, you know, while we worry about nuclear terrorism here, and we may think that a nuclear war on the other side of the world is a problem, but it's a problem for them. It's not. It's a problem for all of humanity.
Haven't heard, you know, people talk much about this since Carl Sagan brought up nuclear winter concept. That was the only connection to the environment that we heard, you know, since the 50s when we were waiting for a radiation cloud to come around.
Exactly. And that caused a great back reaction. But more studies have been done and indeed suggest that nuclear winter, if there was a global nuclear exchange. Of course, if there's a global nuclear exchange, the winter may be not the worst thing we need to
do. One thing I didn't realize, and it was pointed out, I attended that meeting of scientists yesterday, is that there are still hair trigger weapons. What is that?
Again, this is a remarkable and scary thing. Most people don't realize that in spite of the fact that the Cold War is over, we're acting like it hasn't. It isn't over. Both the United States and the Soviet and Russia have at least 1,000 weapons on launch on warning alert, which means if there's a signal that perhaps there's a nuclear warhead coming towards, they launch within 15 minutes. Now, in the case where we were worried about mutually assured destruction, or where we were worried about a huge, you know, 1,000 warhead incoming attack, then we needed to act quickly. But there is no sensible reason, now that the Cold War is over, to have that strategy, and yet we have it, and it is an accident waiting to happen.
It's still there.
It's still there, and a number of people, including someone yesterday at our meeting, suggested that we could unilaterally take our missiles off launch on warning and in fact not be any less safe, but potentially more safe, and induce Russia to do the same thing. Mm. There's so many aspects of current nuclear policy that are fallbacks to a time that doesn't exist any longer and that don't have any strategic value. The fact, a lot of Americans don't realize we have no first use policy. And they think, the United States would never be the first ones to use nuclear weapons again. We did once. We won't do it again. We don't have such a policy, in spite of the fact that, again, there's no rational first use that one could think of, or moral first use, for that matter.
And it was also interesting to hear that scientists were saying that if you just took the word out of – you took nuclear and you put climate change in there, you'd have the same feeling about the inevitability of what could happen if we don't do something about climate change.
Absolutely. There's so many things that are similar. In fact, the movement of the clock was similar for both of them too. Copenhagen at least brought people together, and people recognizing that climate change needs to be dealt with, and we need to address real reductions in carbon dioxide. But it's mostly been talk and not yet action. And so there's hope because of that talk. But if we don't act, then the inevitability of what's going to happen is dramatic. And the same is
So basically, if you didn't act like on nuclear weapons, there's going to be a use of them. And if you don't act on climate change, it's inevitably something's going to happen.
And at the risk, I don't want to be to scare people, but the longer we preserve nuclear weapons and the more nuclear weapons there are in the world, the more likely there will be their use, even by terrorists. And it will be – we shouldn't be lulled by the fact that there have been 65 years of non-nuclear use since World War II. The likelihood that there will be a use of them in this century against the civilian population is large, and the effects would be catastrophic, and we can't be complacent.
All right. Lawrence, thank you for coming today.
Thanks again. It's always good to be here.
Lawrence Krauss is co-chair of the board of sponsors for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. It's also director of the Origins Initiative at Arizona State University in Tempe.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In Joseph Stiglitz's new book, Free Fall, the Nobel laureate and Columbia economics professor gives Washington bad grades on its responses to the three main economic crises we face. Stiglitz is least scathing when it comes to the stimulus bill, which he finds an anemic and insufficient response to the recession. When it comes to the housing and financial crises, he is less charitable. The government has rushed to save institutions it should have let sink, and it has let individuals sink instead of coming to their rescue. Joseph Stiglitz served on and later chaired President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisers. He was also chief economist at the World Bank, and he joins us from New York. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
And I'd like to begin by playing you something that Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said on this program recently. This was his upbeat appraisal of where the economy stands.
The economy is growing again. The policies the president put in place are helping lay the foundation for growth and job creation. And everything we're focused on doing is try to bring forward the time where the economy is creating jobs again, people going back to work, people can be more confident about their financial future, their financial security. And I think Americans can be more confident of that. And if you look carefully at what you see about consumer confidence surveys, surveys of business confidence, if you see how people are behaving again now, you see confidence starting to come back.
Joseph Stiglitz, do you share any of the Treasury Secretary's optimism?
Well, things are better than they were, say, a little over a year ago. But the fact is that even the growth that he's talking about is not sufficient to really create the jobs the economy needs. Unless the economy is growing between 3 and 3.5%, it's not growing enough to create the jobs, let alone to get the unemployment rate down from the 10% that it is today to a more normal level.
Yes, you say that we should look at unemployment or job creation or job losses, not just in absolute terms, but relative to how many jobs we would naturally add to the economy when the economy is growing.
That's right. And normally we would be adding, say, about 150,000 jobs per month. Right now, we're losing jobs.
Do we need a new economic stimulus plan? And if so, wouldn't it be a lot easier to get through the Columbia Economics Department than through the Congress at this stage?
We do need another stimulus plan. At the very least, we need to be ready to put one into place. States and localities are really suffering. There is a shortfall in the revenues. When this current stimulus package comes to an end, those shortfalls in revenues will be even more marked.
Now, I wanted to ask you next about the housing crisis. In Free Fall, in your book, you're very critical of the approach that the administration took to the mortgage crisis. And you describe at one point an alternative of how the government, I'm not sure if you're talking about the Treasury or the Federal Reserve in that case, might have used government funds for people to use to refinance a portion of their mortgage.
Well, exactly. The problem is the government has been using its ability to lend to give money to the banks. If they had lent it on to households, maybe with a little charge for transaction, 1% or 2%, that would bring down their payments, and that would mean that the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people losing their homes and with it their life savings, all of that could have been stymied.
You're saying that somebody, say, with a $300,000 mortgage at 5 or 6% that they're really having trouble paying now could take a chunk of it, say $100,000 of it, and what if they refinance through the Fed at 2%? That would bring down their monthly payments. The government would be helping the borrower instead of the lender of the mortgage, and the person would be no longer underwater on the mortgage?
Well, he'd still be underwater, but his payments would go down by, in the case that you just, the example you gave, paying 6%, going down to 2%, that bring down his payments by two-thirds. And so that would make the house more affordable, more likely that he wouldn't have to go into foreclosure.
How do you explain the fact that it seemed quite obvious to people in Washington to do something for the banks to make money available to them at very low interest rates through the Fed, as opposed to bypassing the banks and making money available to people directly for mortgages at very, very low interest rates?
I think you have to look at the way Washington often works. The banks are there in great presence. There are estimated 5 lobbyists per congressman. So it's no wonder with that kind of clout that the banks get more of what they want and American households get less of what they need.
But you address very often in your book the questions of moral hazard, and you come down on the side that the mortgage crisis is largely about predatory lending practices. Some people would say, yes, there are predatory lending practices, but that person who would get the 2% mortgage loan, let's say, from the Fed that you're talking about, was very possibly extremely imprudent in taking out that mortgage in the first place and should have known better.
Well, he probably was imprudent. But remember, we're talking about, in many cases, first-time home buyers. They were dealing, on the other hand, with banks who they assumed were experts in risk management. They didn't really understand the game that the banks were playing.
You begin your book with an interesting perspective for those of us who have heard often that the economy was humming along quite well until, unexpectedly, it went over a cliff a couple of years ago. From a global perspective, this has been a couple of decades. It's been an era of economic crises.
That's right. From a global perspective, we've had one financial crisis after another. Back in the United States, the last crisis, of course, was the S&L financial crisis that cost us several hundred billion dollars of, and was very expensive for our economy as well. But abroad, we had the Mexican crisis in 1994. A crisis in Thailand, in Indonesia, in Korea, in Argentina, in Brazil, in Russia. So the banks have consistently done a bad job in assessing credit worthiness. They've consistently been bailed out by public institutions. So this is not the first crisis, and we should keep that in mind.
And you would say that when those crises occurred, the remedies that we proposed or demanded were not the remedies that we implemented here.
In fact, just the opposite. When East Asia went into a crisis, we and the IMF demanded that they raise interest rates, that they cut back expenditures, that they raise taxes, that they not bail out their banks. There's a lot of bitterness today in Asia and other developing countries because of the seeming hypocrisy, the difference between what we demanded of those countries and the way we behaved ourselves here in the United States in this crisis.
Joseph Stiglitz, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you.
Joseph Stiglitz is the author of Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. The perpetually beleaguered sport of boxing looked like it had a dream match a month ago. Manny Pacquiao against Floyd Mayweather Jr. in a welterweight title bout between two of the best fighters in the world. And then, in a turn of events that seems all too common in this sport, the bout imploded, apparently over the issue of drug testing. Here to explain all this is our regular Friday sports commentator, Stefan Fatsis. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, Robert.
And first, tell us about the two fighters, Pacquiao and Mayweather.
Well, The Ring magazine ranks Pacquiao and Mayweather 1 and 2 in the world as the best boxers pound for pound. Pacquiao's a remarkable story. He's won championships at 7 weight categories. He's taken on stud after stud en route to winning 50 of 55 professional fights, 38 of them by knockout. He is a legend in his homeland, the Philippines. And Mayweather hasn't lost in 40 professional fights. He is brash, loud, colorful. This would have been a great one.
Sounds like an obvious matchup. What happened?
Well, you know, boxing is controlled by money, and this was envisioned as potentially the sport's biggest payday ever. Promoters for the two fighters started negotiating in November. They agreed to stage the fight at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas on March 13th. It was projected to draw a bigger pay-per-view audience than any fight ever. Pacquiao and Mayweather were projected to earn a payday of up to $40 million apiece, and then when it came down to the nitty-gritty of the negotiations, it all fell apart.
And the nitty-gritty, somewhere near the nitty-gritty at least, is the issue of drug testing. What's going on here?
Well, the backdrop here is that there was pre-existing bad blood between the two sides, as there often is in boxing. Pacquiao's promoter, Bob Arum, had a nasty split from Mayweather a few years back. Mayweather's father, who it should be said is kind of a loose cannon, he had previously implied that Pacquiao had used performance-enhancing drugs. Pacquiao's never tested positive for anything. Boxers, though, usually get past the trash talk in the name of a payday. And in contract negotiations here, though, Mayweather's side insisted on drug testing that exceeded the standards required by the state of Nevada. They wanted Olympic-style random blood and urine testing before and after the fight. Pacquiao's side was offended. Ultimately, it sued Mayweather for defamation. They did agree for a while to blood testing up to 24 days before the fight. Mayweather wanted 14 days. The sides wouldn't budge. The fight was off.
Well, was there anything to this? Did the Mayweather camp have a point about more stringent testing in boxing?
You know, I doubt that this was their intention to help reform the sport or imply some more stringent standards, but it does raise some interesting issues. Boxing does not have a uniform protocol governing pre-fight medical and drug testing. That is left to the individual states or countries whose requirements vary very widely, and some of them are just pretty weak. Promoters do seem to have the legal ability to contract for additional testing, and that wouldn't be a bad thing. It would help protect fighters and their opponents, not only in the case of performance-enhancing drugs, but, say, pre-existing brain injuries. The problem is it's boxing. Self-interest typically rules the day. Getting two sides to agree on anything is complicated, to say the least.
So we don't get the big Mayweather-Pacquiao bout. What do we get instead?
Well, incredibly, we get both of them fighting on March 13th against other boxers. You know, only in boxing would something like this happen. Pacquiao is going to take on Joshua Clottie in the big new Dallas Cowboys football stadium. Mayweather is going to fight an unnamed opponent in Las Vegas, which means that instead of meeting for a title and a record pay-per-view payday, they're going to compete with each other for fan attention. Boxing can't be surprised that mixed martial arts is eating into its audience. It's stuff like this that just turns fans off.
Will bouts like the ones you're describing, will they actually outdraw mixed martial arts on television?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, mixed martial arts has had bouts of well over a million pay-per-view buys. And one of the reasons that Ultimate Fighting, which is the main organizer of mixed martial arts, is growing is that there's a central body. They cut sponsorship deals. They keep all of the fighters in one camp. And boxing does feel threatened. Back in September, Bob Arum, the Pacquiao promoter, derided the Ultimate Fighting as a bunch of skinhead white guys watching people in the ring who also look like skinhead white guys. And that was before he made a homophobic slur about the sport. That, to me, is just the first cry of a wounded animal.
Thank you, Stefan.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
Stefan Fatsis, who joins us most Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports. And you can hear him some more on Slate.com's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen.